this and try to give you, I thought about the approach I gave you. Let me try to be with some repetition built in. Let me try to give you the big picture in this course. And I think this is the course to follow. I don't know how much Dean Chambers gets into evolution. Is it getting quite a bit? This is the course to look at it and see what's going on. Let me give you the big picture. Okay? And the problems in it, or how to think about it, and where the state of the question is, and we'll probably present it today, all day today, probably sometime next week. Okay. What about evolution?
What we mean is macroevolution. In popular parlance, we need to... That is, first of all, again, let's
get the big... Don't you see it in its totality? That
when we talk about the theory of evolution versus creation, it is macroevolution we're talking about. That's what people mean by it. Okay? General evolution.
Somebody told me I need to take your cultural anthropology.
Nah, I ruined it. Yeah, I see it. I'm not stupid.
There are two major areas of evolution to be analyzed. One is prebiotic evolution. What does that suggest to you? Prebiotic. Before life, or chemical evolution, it's called. Prebiotic evolution. Now, in prebiotic evolution, I've divided it this way to help make sure you. There are five stages of prebiotic evolution, and it goes this way. There is, first of all, what's supposed to be, I'll put this in quotation marks, the early Earth atmosphere. Early Earth atmosphere. That is, water, hydrogen, methane, and so forth. The basic elements. Yes.
Primordial soup.
Yeah, the prebiotic soup. Primordial soup. Then, next stage in degrees of complexity that follows that is the hot dilute soup. With these, and here we have acids, sugars, and so forth, which are more complex. You understand? Which are more complex than you put together water, hydrogen, methane, basically you get acid, sugars. Then there is the level of widespread polymerization, which gives you the peptides, carbohydrates, so forth, followed by protocells, followed by what does proto mean?
Model.
It
means that it's on its way to being
cells, and then true cells. But that's just an outline of
of chemical evolution. That is, now with true cells you have life. Start with biological evolution. So this is prebiotic evolution is here. So it takes us to here. Okay. Now, and so you start with the primordial soup. The material organizes itself into a hot dilute soup with acids, amino acids, sugars, and so forth. And then you have polymerization. Poly means many come together in a synthesis, forming peptides, carbohydrates, into early protocells and the true cells. Now, what are the major problems with this? First major problem is the problem of artificiality. In experiments, I'm going to give you that one, then we'll come back and talk about some of these in particular. Artificiality in experiments, i.e., that is the myth of prebiotic soup. Second problem is the problem of the isomer preferences. Now, what isomer preferences are is that, let's get these written down, then we can make sure you have a copy that we'll talk about. Isomer preferences. The third is the problem of the gap between proto and true cells, protocells and true cells. Third and fourth there is the problem of biological significant biologically significant information. The fifth there is the problem of thermodynamics. Let me know something about that. Thermodynamics. Can you read my writing well enough to know what we're doing? Did y'all get this? Okay, this says isomer preferences, gap between proto and true cells, biologically significant information, and thermodynamics. Those are the problem areas, regardless of what position you take. Now, okay? Let's take this one. Artificiality in experiments. If you study this, the primary experiment was done by it's called the Miller-Urey synthesis, in which Miller back in the 50s, took basic elements like water, hydrogen, methane, and he boiled the tar out of them for long periods of time and got some basic acids, amino acids, among some other things. This was supposed to have really been significant. Now, the problem is that what they have to do in these, and it's been duplicated, it's been made since Miller, he was the pioneer, there's been hundreds of experiments to take basic elements and agitate them in various ways, heat them, to try to get them to spontaneously form into more complex acids and sugars and so forth. There was some degree of success. The problem with this is they had a very low level of success. The problem is that they start with an assumed primordial or prebiotic mixture of chemicals, commonly called the soup, which, as a matter of fact, did not exist. It's a myth. Give me an example of this. Hoyle, Fred Hoyle, says this, very interesting. He's a Piedmont, he's not a creationist, but he talks about he analyzes this in his book, Chance of the Universe. He gives example. He gives pictures of Miller's experiments. You've seen those in textbooks many times. They boil the mixture to trap the what results and try to get it together. He says this as a summary statement. In short, there is not a shred of objective evidence to support the hypothesis that life began in an organic soup here on the Earth. Indeed, Francis Crick, who shared a Nobel Prize for the discovery of the structure of DNA, is one biophysicist who finds this theory unconvincing. So why do biologists indulge in the unsubstantiated fantasies in order to deny what is so patently obvious, that the point that the 200,000 amino acid chains, and hence life, did not appear by chance? The answer lies as why, if it's so clearly obvious, he said, that this Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, and many others have pointed out, it's clearly obvious that these experiments are very artificial. It's such a, first of all, that the yields are so low grade, they are simply insignificant. If you assume this prebiotic soup, which is an unsubstantiated assumption, which is unlikely, he says this, so why is it so widely accepted? Why is it still in the textbooks? And it is. The answer lies in a theory developed over a century ago, which sought to explain the development of life as an inevitable product of purely local natural processes. Its author, Charles Darwin, hesitated to challenge the church's doctrine on the creation, and publicly at least did not trace the implications of his ideas back to their bearing on the origin of life. However, he privately suggested that life may have been produced, to quote some warm little pond, end quote. And to this day, his followers have sought to explain the origin of terrestrial life in terms of the process of chemical evolution from the primordial soup. But as we have seen, this simply does not fit the facts. In pre-Copernican days, the Earth was thought erroneously to be geometrical and the physical center of the universe. Nowadays, it seems respectable science, in seemingly respectable science, the Earth is taken to be the biological center of the universe, an almost incredible repetition of this previous error. And in his very interesting book, came out in 83, by Faxton Bradley Knowles, The Mystery of Life's Origin, which are written by scientists, of course. He says this on this biotic soup. He has two chapters on it, and then he gives it. This is his summary. Based on the foregoing geochemical assessment, it's very technical, this assessment of it. Exceedingly technical. You can see the nature of it, that he works out the tables and chemical probabilities and so forth. It's not, see that? Very, very technical. He says, based on the foregoing geochemical assessment, we conclude that both in the atmosphere and the various water basins of the primitive Earth, many destructive interactions would have so vastly diminished, if not altogether consumed, come to this is thermodynamics, consumed essential precursor chemicals, that's here, precursor chemicals, that the chemical evolution rates would have been negligible. The soup would have been too dilute for direct polymerization to occur. Got this? So you can't get from here to here. Even local ponds for concentrated soup ingredients would have met with the same problem. Furthermore, I'll talk about that problem a bit later. Listen to this statement. No geological evidence indicates an organic soup, even in a small organic pond, ever existed on this planet. It is becoming clear, however, that life began on Earth. The usually conceived notion that life emerged from an oceanic soup of organic chemicals is a most implausible hypothesis. We may therefore, with fairness, call this scenario, quote, the myth of the prebiotic soup. That doesn't mean we won't get the textbooks. Here you have, there's an example of men, of leading scientists who simply say that the thing breaks down here. Even if you grant it, that there was a prebiotic soup, which is not granted at all. The second area, you understand that? So the second area is isomer preferences. Isomer preferences. That is, acids and sugars are not homogeneous. That is, there are acids and sugars and other basic chemicals which are supposed to be at this level. They are divided chemically. If you had chemistry, they are divided optically. It's called, and they are built into it. There are different kinds. It's like they're almost like mirror images. They're not all the same. They're divided optically. That is, in their, by the way, they refract light. And for instance, amino acids, which are the basic elements at this level, these acids which are formed out of the basic elements, amino acids, there are two kinds. There are L, optically classified L amino acids. Some amino acids are L acids, optically classified. Some amino acids are D acids, optically classified. Got that? L and D. And they appear in nature, synonymously. That is, you find equal mixtures of both of them. They're just both there. And in these experiments, for instance, whenever they boil this stuff, Miller and those who followed him, they always get a random mixture of L and D. Some come out L, some come out D, and there's no preference either way. Understand? You get both. And anytime you, and when you look at nature, you get both. There's no way to sift out one from the other in these experiments. It's come out roughly an equal mixture of both. The problem is that in proteins, proteins only use L amino acids. Never find D amino acids in protein. This is called isomer preferences. An isomer preference. So it is with sugars, for example. In sugars, nucleic acids are all D rather than L. The amino acids are L, not D. The nucleic acids, N-U-C-L-E-I-C, are all D and not L. And those acids appear randomly and synonymously. That is, the process to form proteins not only had to produce these acids, but screen out all of one kind and use only the other, which is totally inexplicable by the spontaneous generation theory, and this kind of spontaneous generation theory. And interestingly, the scientists have been working on it for 30 years and are not one step closer than they were to explaining isomer preferences. In fact, this is one of the major arguments in this book. This is what they say. It says this. Another intractable problem concerns the spontaneous origin of the optical isomer preferences found universally in living matters. After all the prodigious effort that has gone into attempts to solve this great question over the years, we are really no nearer to a solution today than we were 30 years ago. That is, you don't get, you have, so that's, you understand that? The third area of problem in this whole in prebiotic evolution is the problem of the gap between the protocell and the true cell. Because a true cell is vastly more complex than a protocell. What they do is they lump together peptides and carbohydrates, which you can polymerize these. You get peptides, carbohydrates, and that level of chemical commodity.
And they can successfully get lumps of them, clumps of them. And they call this protocells because they contain the basic chemicals in a cell. So they're protocells. But the gap between the what they call the protocell, and the true cell is vast. The difference is biologically significant information, among other things. It's like this. That is, it is analogous, although the gap is even greater than this, but it is analogous to taking all the base metals and plastics, all the base chemicals, and in their polymerized form, so you would get plastics and base metals, not alloy, the base metals, that go up to making a 747, and taking all those metals in the proper amounts, enough to make a 747, putting them together, and saying, well, we've got a proto 747. What you have is a level of organization that is several notches below the level of organization you get after a plane crash. You took a 747 and flew it full speed into an object that would not give, that disintegrated the thing. Then you broke that down several more levels of disintegration to the base metals. Then you start with that, and you could call that what we really got here. And these probably totally unorganized metals, plastics, what we've got there is a proto 747. It's the lick of the promise, I told you before. Well, the difference would be greater than the difference between a protocell and a true cell. For instance, a protocell has no information, no biologically significant information. A true cell, an amoeba, has information which, if you wrote it out, would take several volumes. Some say several hundred volumes, the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. With all the words in the right order, understand? Exceedingly complex. That is, listen to me. That's the difference between a protocell and a cell. What's all the difference in the world? And this, you get the point? So this gap is humongous. In fact, it's overwhelming. Okay, I mentioned this. Other aspects of origin of life research have contributed to my growing uneasiness about the theory of chemical evolution. One of these is the enormous gap between the most complex, quote, protocell model systems produced in the laboratory and the simplest living cells. Anyone familiar with the ultra-structural and biochemical complexity of the genus Mycoplasma, which is an exceedingly simple cell, for example, should have serious doubts about the relevance of any of the various laboratory, quote, protocells to the actual history of the origin of cells. In my view, the possibility of closing this gap by laboratory simulation of chemical events likely to have occurred in the primitive Earth is extremely remote. That is, what he's saying is, to use my analogy of the 747, if you took all these base chemicals and plastics in completely unorganized form, with no structure whatever, and you simply shook them together long enough, eventually you'd get a 747. No, the gap is really this example. I found this in human evolution, physical anthropology, that they really create evidence by terminology. This is one of my primary gripes with evolutionism. They create evidence by terminology. That is, I noticed. I talked with my professor, the duplicity, really, that's maybe too strong a word, but the duplicity in calling certain animals, extinct animals, humanoids.
give them an aura, an appearance, and a respectability by adding the word boys,
even though our human knows that there's a long way.
And to call a lump of chemicals a protocell is exceedingly deceitful. Because you give the impression that it's almost a cell, that it's recognizably on the way to being a cell, when as a matter of fact, that is not true. It is not true. And then the last problem is the problem of thermodynamics. Well, by the way, this problem of biologically significant information, it picks up and carries on when you talk about biotic evolution. Thermodynamics is especially important at the level of chemical or prebiotic evolution. What is thermodynamics? Thermodynamics, of course, is the recognized principle that matter in a closed system, that is where there is no outside interference, chemically or mechanically, in the way, that in a closed system, matter disintegrates. It goes, entropy or probability increases because it is more likely to become more things, not fewer things. It breaks down, not builds up. And the common textbook answer is that the problem of thermodynamics is overcome by the input of energy. The sun, primarily, but not just the sun, lightning, shock waves, ultraviolet light, is part of sunlight. That is, when you inject energy into a system, that energy creates order. And as Hoyle and many as others are pointing out, that without information which directs energy, without an antecedent source of information, energy is not integrating, it is disintegrating. It breaks things down. What are you talking about? I thought about taking your plant to the seashore. You get a sunburn or you get photosynthesis. What's the difference? This is information that guides it. A mechanism of conversion of energy. In other words, you have to have a conversion. If you do not have a mechanism that converts energy along certain lines, then you get randomness and disintegration. And as many point out, without a mechanism to convert the energy to something of higher organization or something useful, and without information to guide that process, energy becomes a very active disintegrative force. You see, it's simply the introduction of energy doesn't do it. You ever heard of the bull in the china shop? Put a bull in the china shop and you have a high introduction of a source of high energy. But you do not, as a result, get an increase in the organization of what's in the china shop. You get a disintegration. You can introduce a bull to a cow and get life. But you have to have what? DNA, the mechanism, and information already there. Now, any questions on this? Those are the primary, that's the nature of the discussion. Those are the parameters of the discussion. Yes?
You mentioned number five about thermodynamics. That occurs in a closed system?
Yes.
Is it determined that we live in a closed
system? Yes, it is. Well, the common answer, I've been told this in the university, the common answer is, well, Earth is not a closed system, but the sun is shining on it. Energy from outside. So the problem with that doesn't say anything. The Earth is a closed system because the Earth is a part of the universe. The universe is a closed system. And the sun shining on the Earth, apart from an antecedent energy converting mechanism and information to guide the process, is simply degenerate. What he points out is that the earth, that the sun shining, what they say is the introduction of energy at this level, and the introduction of energy at this level would be so overwhelmingly degenerative, it would dilute the process, to break down whatever chance collection of chemicals might assemble themselves into. Well, that is the problem. And what my point is, and what many scientists are now saying, a growing number, is that these are overwhelming. That these outvote prebiotic evolution. It's a nice idea, but it didn't work. Notice, any one of those would be fatal. But they have a cumulative effect. They feed each other. Understand that? They are. So when you don't suddenly add them up to five, or they add up to the death sentence of human evolution. Do I can I erase this? Now, I'm not going to put on the board all my diagrams from before about biological evolution or biotic evolution. Let's use the more exact term, biotic evolution.
Somebody doesn't want that board.
Non-biotic evolution. What were the problems? Remember the two? The biotic evolution. What were the problems involved in this? Remember? Gradualism? Problems with Neo-Darwinism? The problems are gradualism and what?
Probabilities.
Gradualism and probabilities. And I mentioned symposium we might add one to that because I listed there's the problem of discontinuity in the fossil record. Discontinuity in the fossil record. That's sort of paleontological difficulty. Let me give you some examples. Now, following my habit, when I lecture on this, I never or almost never use creation as sources. Okay? Let's talk about this discontinuity first, the fossil record. This is a book I used at the university, Evolution of Man. It's an anthology edited by Lewis Young. It contains representative statements by all the leading when the book came out. Sort of the history of the development of the theory of evolution of man. And, it says this. Listen to this. This is a little essay by a fellow. It's called Internal Factors in Evolution by Bertalanffy. He's one of the pioneers, wrote in 1952. Bertalanffy, Ludwig von Bertalanffy. He writes this. Here we come. Here we come to an important problem. The theory of evolution, based upon an enormous amount of factual evidence, he believes in states that the animal and plant kingdoms, this is biotic evolution now, states that the animal and plant kingdoms have arisen in the course of geological time from simpler and more primitive forms to more complicated and more highly organized ones. Genetical experience, that's what the theory says, simple to complex. Genetical experience leads us to accept as a fact that this has happened by way of step-like mutations, mutations, hybrid genes. Actually, however, we find, listen to this, we find no evidence, remember my little gaps between macro and micro, that's the way I diagram it. This is general and macro. Okay, you're talking about this gap in here. Well, listen to this, it's quite ambitious. So we accept it as a fact. Actually, however, the theory tells us to expect this step-by-step changes, well, one leading into the other. Actually, however, we find no evidence, either in the living world today or of past geologic epochs, for a continuous transition. I'll talk about modern biological evidence, living forms, finding careful gaps between the kinds, and the same thing exists in the fossil record, so nothing whatever. Look what he says. Actually, however, we find no evidence, either in the living world of today or of past geological epochs, for a continuous transition. What we actually find are separate and well-distinguished species. Kind of reads like Genesis 1, doesn't it? That's what we actually find. Even the existence of more or less numerous mutations, races, subspecies, and so forth, and I talked about the difficulty of classification taxonomy, even the existence of more or less numerous mutations, races, subspecies, and so forth, within the species, does not alter the basic fact that intermediate stages from one species to another, which should be found if there were a gradual transition, are not met with. The worlds of organisms, living and extinct, do not represent a continuum, but a discontinuum. My question is, why don't statements like that ever get into the textbooks? Now, this is how he ends this discussion. Ontology, ready? This is only going to be a paragraph. While fully appreciating modern selection theory, nevertheless, we arrive at an essentially different view of evolution. It appears to be not a series of accidents, the course of which is determined only by the change of environments during Earth's history and the resulting struggle for existence, which leads to selection within a chaotic material of mutations. No more is it, to be sure. That is, what we see is not, and obviously not, simple random change. No more is it, to be sure, the work of mysterious factors, such as the striving for perfection or a tendency towards purposiveness or adaptation. Well, he's admitting an adaptation simply is an inadequate explanation. But it appears as if, now listen to this with you, that it appears as a process essentially co-determined by organic laws. That's obviously what we see here in the universe. We don't see the continuum, we see the discontinuum. Through micro and macro. And he says, obviously there is something operative here other than chance. Now listen to this. Which in suitable cases can be formulated in the exact way. And we believe, love that word, brother. We believe that the discovery of these laws constitutes the most important task of the future theory of evolution. Listen to that statement. We believe the discovery of these laws, that is, how evolution took place, constitutes one of the most important tasks of the future theory of evolution. Remember, I told you one of the laws I concocted for studying this for years. Given enough time in the past, anything can happen. Given enough time in the future, we'll figure out how. This is where I got it from, this kind of stuff.
This is what is being said. What evidence do we have of evolution? We know it happened. Why? Well, we just know it happened. Do we see it in the fossil record?
No.
Do we see it in biological forms? Living forms?
No.
Do we have any idea of how it happened?
No.
Are we sure that it happened?
Yes.
On what basis?
Well, we're here, aren't we?
Doesn't that seem to point toward the fact that they're getting closer and closer to
you? Yeah, they aren't. They're farther away. We're losing ground. But my point is, listen, my point is, you missed two things. Number one, there's no evidence of anything but microevolution. Secondly, the process by which this happened is for the future. Now, you see how this contrasts to the picture, what I call this certainty, this pseudo-scientific certainty you see in the textbooks. You don't get that kind of... You don't get this, well, we don't, you know, in the future we're going to figure it out kind of stuff in most textbooks. I asked my professor about that one time. He assigned me to read a book on human evolution. He wrote a chapter. I'll get the page, my first page, page 16, and the guy said there was no evidence. He was talking about the red thing he's talking about. There's no evidence. And on the seventh page on page 23, he was ready to build over his argument. And so he used the word certain in this. I was on the question. I said, yeah, I was supposed to read the book and ask the questions. I had a question for him. I said, no. Plus, on page 16, there's no evidence. And built upon that, starting at page 22, we have certainty. I said, no matter what. What epistemology builds certainty on no evidence? His answer was, we have no evidence. Do we have any evidence here? Yeah, certainly. Well, that's a very religious thing to say. Very spiritual. Well, my point is, but this is simply, I just brought this book because this is representative. What we find is there's no evidence for continuous transition. Now, this is going to come back later when I get into the modern. See, I'm still talking about, you understand, I'm still talking about neo-Darwinism. I haven't got to the latest theories yet. I'm trying to show you why neo-Darwinism is breaking down. This is one of the examples. No evidence. Remember I talked to you about the mathematical, the Wistar Institute, mathematical challenges to neo-Darwinism, where the mathematicians called really, the reason I didn't list this separately, let me back up a second. This continuity really is part of this problem, okay? Because you don't find gradualism in the fossil record. Gradualism requires continuity, which isn't there. Okay. And I've tried to make the point a number of times that when you look at the godfathers of evolution, you don't find this nice, smooth, slick certainty that you find in textbooks. It's about 2 minutes till our break. Let me stop here. Give us a break. I'm going to read the next verse from it for some different reasons. You'll see. Let me check it out. This is a statement by Sir Peter Medawar, Britisher. He's the head of the National Institute for Medical Research. Not the name of it. He was one of the. Remember, I said the mathematicians called the biologists and other scientists to this symposium. He said this, and this was there some different ones made opening remarks. He said this. This is sort of you'll see why it's interesting. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This isn't very long. I want to make just a few introductory remarks. I think it is the distinguishing mark of all true biologists, as opposed to mere sectarian specialists, that they are deeply interested in the mechanism of evolution. As Dr. Kaplan has explained, the immediate cause of this conference, listen to this, the immediate cause of this conference is a pretty widespread sense of dissatisfaction about what is come to be thought of as the accepted evolutionary theory in the English-speaking world, the so-called neo-Darwinian theory.
a wide, pretty widespread sense of dissatisfaction, which they have never conveyed to the textbook writers.
What year was this?
1967. I've been accused of misrepresenting the situation when I point out that there's a level of certainty in textbooks that does not exist in the discipline itself for philosophical reasons.
So in 2006, that statement will be in the books?
No, I never will. But note this widespread sense of dissatisfaction. You sure wouldn't get that from Carl Sagan, watching Carl Sagan on television. He's satisfied. This dissatisfaction has been expressed from three quarters. And it is not only scientific, first of all, religious. Where once the complaint was that evolution happened at all, now the complaint generally is that it happens without divine motivation. Many of you will have read the incredulous horror of the kind of pious bunk written by Teilhard de Chardin on this subject. Then there were philosophical and methodological objections to evolutionary theory. They had been very well voiced by Professor Karl Popper in the popular controversy with Popper. Where Popper says that theory of evolution can only be viewed not as a scientific theory but as a philosophy of biology because it's not subject to falsification. Very controversial. Anyway, he says, they have been very well, these philosophical objections, have been very well voiced by Dr. Karl Popper. Then it's the Kuhn-Popper debate. Got to the other side of Kuhn. Professor McCormack, I was talking about that. Been very well noticed by Professor McCormack that the current neo-Darwinian theory has the methodological defect of explaining too much. It is too difficult to imagine or envisage an evolutionary episode which could not be explained by the formula of neo-Darwinism. Finally, and these are really, I think, the only objections that should concern us, as supposedly, there are objections made by fellow scientists who feel that in the current theory something is missing. God says something is missing. And we look forward to hearing your formulation of what precisely is missing. These objections to current neo-Darwinian theory are very widely held among biologists generally. Objections widely held. And we must on no account, I think, make light of them. The very fact that we are having this conference is evidence that we are not making light of them. Now, what does that say? Well, it's real. I'm leading up to I'm talking about the kind of thinking that is leading up to the abandonment of neo-Darwinism by the scientists. And I'm going to say later on, I'll say it is one of the most humorous, I thought about humorous, the bitter irony of this is the very arguments they're using now, the arguments of creation they've been using for years. For decades, they were discounted as superstitious nonsense, and the creationists made the argument. Now all of a sudden, they become respected. Same argument. Those things I put on the board, maybe those put on the board, you know, those objections to end of evolution. Then, you know, I said Murray Eden was one of the leaders in this, from MIT, mathematician MIT. He said this. His speech is Inadequacies of Neo-Darwinism, Evolution as a Scientific Theory. An excerpt from that. Aside from the pre-Darwinian postulate that offspring resemble their parents, which everybody knew anyway, only one major tenet of Neo-Darwinian evolution can be said to retain empirical content as can be tested scientifically, using science in its pure sense. Namely, that offspring vary from parental types in a random way. It is our contention that if random is given a serious and crucial interpretation from a probabilistic point of view, what's the question? Probabilities. So if we take random for what it obviously means from a probabilistic point of view, the randomness postulate is highly implausible, and that an adequate scientific theory of evolution must await the discovery and elucidation of new natural laws physical, chemical, and biological. And what did Bertholdi said? We await these new principles, new laws. What we know now, it won't work. Exactly what he's saying. From a probabilistic point of view, until such a time, neo-Darwinian evolution is a restatement in current terminology of Darwin's seminal insight that the origin of species can have a naturalistic explanation. And he says, until we get the evidence, new or new laws, then he's simply all we're doing is simply stating an assumption, not explaining it. Listen to this. The complexity of the argument, quote, there's not nearly enough time available. What he's saying is, first of all, I'm going to point out there's not enough, even if you give the evolutions all the time he wants, it's not enough time. A number of specific arguments may be given, only two will be sketched here. And I'm not going to talk, I'm going to talk just the first one. Current multicellular organisms, anything about a one cell animal, current, are you all following this okay? I have this in print, I advise the syllabus, but I'm talking. Many, since multicellular organisms develop in quite specific ways, I say so, close your toes and eyes rise and everything. It is assumed that to each organism there is associated an algorithm in some finite alphabet for the production of the phenotype within some expected range of environments, that is, information and design. For the sake of concreteness, we may think of the linear DNA chain as embodying the algorithm, and that the algorithm prescribes the orderly formation of specific polypeptide chains to create certain kinds of forms. Clearly, to every ancestor of an organism living today, there is associated a meaningful DNA sequence. In humans, the linear DNA sequence is estimated to contain on the order of 10 to the raised to the power of 9 nucleotides. Taking the length of time that has existed on Earth to be the order of 1 billion years, we find that the average rate of accretion, as buildup, is about one meaningful nucleotide to the DNA sequence per year. If randomness is taken to mean that a uniform probability is assigned to each possible independent substitution or addition, the chance of emergence of man is like the probability of typing at random a meaningful library of 1,000 volumes using the following procedure. We grant you your theory. Here's what the mathematician is saying to the biologist. We grant you your theory of adding one nucleotide to the DNA chain per year at random. That's the only way it can be. Here's what you get. He says it's the probability of typing a library of 1,000 volumes using the following procedure. Begin with a meaningful phrase. My dog loves, my dog has fleas. A meaningful phrase. Retype it with a few mistakes. And rearrange. Retype it with a few mistakes, make it longer by adding letters, not words, letters, and rearrange subsequences in the string of letters, then examine the result to see if the new phrase is meaningful. Repeat this process until the library is complete. You see, what happens is, when he says, first of all, you type the letter, type a phrase, a sentence. And then you type it again, making some mistakes. Because you see, any change in DNA is an error, not in the chain, the sequences. Then you simply add at random some letters. Got that? And then rearrange these letters and see if you get a word. Or if you do get a word, see if it makes sense in the statement. Then you start all over again. You type what you got again, make some mistakes, add some letters,
shake the letters together, see if they make a word, or see if they add meaning to the sentence, and then type the sentence, and then whatever you got, type it again with a few mistakes. What would you get eventually? You did this for very long. Yeah, would you add to the input, would you add to the order, to the sensibility of the sentence? No, what you're doing is, he's pointing out, you destroy the sentence. So what you end up, if you do this long enough, do you get a library of 1,000 volumes? No. What you get is a meaningless chain of letters. Now, you got that. So that's why that's the kind of thing they're pointing out. Randomness. Henry Coyle's book over there. Hoyle, on the same order, says this. And some of it I've already introduced this to you. This is maybe this book. He says this. You know, it's the same kind of argument that Murray is using. Whatever you might think of that. A generation or more ago, a profound disservice was done to popular thought by the notion that a horde of monkeys thumping away on typewriters could eventually arrive at the plays of Shakespeare. This idea is wrong. So wrong that one has to wonder how it came to be broadcast so widely. The answer, I think, is that scientists wanted to believe that anything at all, even the origin of life, could happen by chance, if only chance operated on a big enough scale. This is the obvious error, for the whole universe observed by astronomers would not be remotely large enough to hold a whole horde of monkeys needed to write even one scene from one Shakespearean play, or to hold their typewriters. The universe isn't big enough to hold the monkeys, or to hold even the monkeys, let alone the typewriters. I like this. And certainly not the waste paper baskets needed for throwing out the volumes of rubbish which the monkeys would type. If the universe were big enough to hold the monkeys, it wouldn't hold the typewriters. But taking up more space than either the monkeys or the typewriters would be the paper they had to throw away from the mistakes they made in trying to type a Shakespearean play. I'm talking not a whole play, but just one scene of one play. You kind of get the idea of Hoyle, doesn't it? You're saying the same thing, even the same. The striking point is that the only practicable way for the universe to produce the plays of Shakespeare was through the existence of life producing Shakespeare himself. Despite this, listen to this, the entire structure of orthodox biology, it's a textbook textbook evolution, the entire structure of orthodox biology still holds that life arose at random. Yet, as biochemists discover more and more about the awesome complexity of life, it is apparent that the chances of it originating by accident are so minute that they can be completely ruled out. Life cannot have arisen by chance. Life's improbable building blocks. The probability of life appearing spontaneously on Earth is so small that it is very difficult to grasp without comparing it with something more familiar. Imagine a blindfolded person trying to solve a recently fashionable Rubik's Cube. Since he can't see the results of his moves, they must all be at random. He has no way of knowing whether he is getting near the solution, whether he is scrambling the cube still further. One would be inclined to say that moving the faces at random would never achieve a solution. Strictly speaking, never is wrong, however. If our blindfolded subject were to make one random move every second, it would take on average of 300 times the age of the Earth. One bit, which is 1,050,000,000 years. Taking 300 times the age of the Earth to solve a cube. The chance against each move producing perfect color matching for all the cube spaces is about 50, the number 50 followed by 18 zeros to 1. The odds are roughly the same as you would give to the idea of just one of our body's proteins having evolved randomly. That's chemical evolution. By chance. However, we use about got the odds of taking the chance of
working the Rubik's Cube, each tribe blindfolded, or 1 in 55 18 zeros to 1. I'm sorry, 1 in 50 or 18 zeros to 1. As a result of the odds of getting just one of our body's protein, not a cell, it's a protein. However, we use about 200,000 types of proteins in our cell, protein in our cells. If the odds against the random creation of one protein are the same as those against the random solution of the Rubik's Cube, then the odds against the random creation of all of the 200,000 are almost unimaginably vast. He goes on and talks about the complexity of protein molecules. Then he says this. He gives the odds. He said, in total, there are perhaps, when he talked about enzymes, although the chance, he's talking about enzymes, I'm moving ahead. Well, the chance of finding all the enzymes, 2,000 of them, by random process, is not nearly as small as the chance of finding the whole 200,000 proteins on which life depends. The chance is still exceedingly minute, called X to 1 against. You start writing an X out of longhand form, beginning with the digit 1, adding zeros, you would have a few hours of work ahead. It would take 40 pages of zeros, one in 10 followed by 40. This number is 1 followed by 40 pages of zeros. It is about the same as the chance of throwing an uninterrupted sequence of 50,000 sixes with unbiased dice. I think dice aren't loaded. Your chances of throwing 50,000 straight double sixes. This is a crucial statistic because it seems that without these 2,000 enzymes being formed in exactly the correct way, complex living organisms simply could not operate. Then he goes on to say that then he makes this famous statement that I quoted before. The popular idea that life could have arisen spontaneously on Earth dates back to experiments that caught the public imagination earlier in the century. I'm talking about Miller Urey. If you stir up simple non-organic molecules like water, ammonia, methane, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen cyanide with almost any form of intense energy, ultraviolet light for instance, some of the molecules reassemble themselves into amino acids at stage 2. A result demonstrated about 30 years ago by Stanley Miller and Harold Urey. The amino acids, the individual building blocks of proteins, can therefore be produced by natural means. But this is far from proving that life could evolve in this way. This creation has been saying this for years, you see. It's interesting. No one has shown that the correct arrangements of amino acids, like the ordering in enzymes, can be produced by this method. See, it's not enough just to get the acid, the amino acids. You got to get the optically correct amino acids, L's, and you got to get them in the proper sequences. No evidence for this huge jump in complexity has ever been found, nor, in my opinion, will it be. Nevertheless, many scientists have made this leap. From the formation of individual amino acids to the random formation of whole chains of amino acids like enzymes, in spite of the obviously huge odds against such an event having ever taken place on the Earth, and this quite unjustified conclusion has stuck. In a popular lecture, I once unflatteringly described the thinking of these scientists as a quote junkyard mentality. Since this reference became widely and not quite accurately quoted, I will repeat it here. A junkyard contains all the bits and pieces of the Boeing 747 dismembered in disarray. A whirlwind happens to blow through the yard. What is the chance that after its passage, a fully assembled 747 ready to fly will be found standing there? So small as to be negligible, even if a tornado were to blow through enough junkyards to fill the whole universe. So, how do those who claim that life originated in an organic soup imagine that complex life developed? When he goes on and talks about biotic evolution. a couple more things here. It's, he's comes over, this is a couple of pages later. In short, this is what I've already read this. There is not a shred of objective evidence to support the hypothesis about the Baalic Sea. Now, one more point, and this is a very important statement in connection with this course, the history of and logic of science. Listen to this. This is an opening paragraph in page 2, the Gospel according to Darwin. One more paragraph. How has the Darwinian theory of evolution by natural selection managed for upwards of a century to fasten itself like a superstition on so-called enlightened opinion? Why is the theory still defended so vigorously? Personally, I love this statement. Personally, I have little doubt that scientific historians in the future will find it mysterious that a theory could be seen to be unworkable, that a theory which could be seen to be unworkable came to be so widely believed. Now, Malcolm Mumfries, the eminent British author, who's a creationist, he makes this statement. He says the same other way. He says that future historians are blasphemous for believing in evolution, and especially for allowing it to be taught in our schools. Interesting, Hoyle says the same thing. The future historians, scientific historians, are going to think it very strange that we believe in Neil Darwin. They're going to find it very odd. In other words, future historians are going to look back at Neil Darwinism from 1925 to now. And they're going to say the same thing about us, our generation, as we say about some people in the Middle Ages who thought the world was flat. We're going to say, how could they possibly have believed that? Weren't they thinking people? And yet that is the very concept that our kids are being fed that's supposed to outvote Christianity and creation. The explanation they, that is these future historians, are trying to explain why we believe this, why it's so accepted, the explanation they will offer will, I think, be based less on the erroneous nature of the theory itself and more on the social changes and historical circumstances that surrounded its development. You're going to talk about the philosophical back reasons behind it? To understand how Darwin's ideas gained supremacy, we have to look back over three centuries. The history of classical biology, and he goes on. So what he does, he talks about how the idea developed. And he goes back to Lyell and Malthus and the whole thing which I taught you. And points out that it was really, you have to understand the history of the idea to understand how it can be accepted, not anything else. Yes.
Does he use that whole book, except for the part that he gives in his theory, does he use the whole book as a key?
Yes, what he does in this book, I'm going to bring the book back in my talk about one another thing later on. The way he does in this book, when I talk about scientism, in this book, he does two things. He systematically destroys neo-Darwinism. And when you read it, you see, the thing about this is, you get some modern evolutionists who read that, and you'd be very amazed at what he reads. You've never read it before. Now, somebody like me, it's old stuff, because it's been creation science, and he's been saying this for years. He just uses all the arguments that the creation science has been using for decades to show that this neo-Darwinism is not unworkable. Then, what he does, what he says is, it's obvious, I'll just, because the book is important, you know where the book is. What he says in the book is, this shows his own philosophical blindness. He says, it's obvious, and he talks about the gaps in the fossil record, no transitional forms. He says, it's obvious that there has had to have been the systematic introduction of genetic information, as a key thing, information. He said, without that, he said, it's simply idiotic, it's not his word, that's what he's saying, to conceive of the present biological order without the introduction of information. And what he says is,
that just like he said that the universe, he said that there is, what he says is that we talk about in the title of his book, The Intelligent Universe. So obviously he says, listen to me, he says very clearly that there is a source, there is a level of information existing somewhere, like existing apart from Earth, which is greater than the information on Earth. For evolution to take place, he's an evolutionist now, but not a neo-Darwinist evolution. He's not a neo-Darwinist. He says it doesn't work. On what basis of evolution? Here's what he says. That the Earth, I want you to get this. This is worth everything you paid for this course. What you find on the Earth is information which came into the cells, came into the biological forms from without, from the universe, because you have, for evolution to have taken place, you had to have the inculcation, the insertion of advanced levels of information. So what he says is that there exists, basically says, that there exists in the universe from some source, which he does not know, a higher level of information, a higher level of intelligence, there exists a level of intelligence greater than the intelligence on Earth, and this intelligence is being transferred to the Earth and inculcated in biotic forms in the same way that, in a way analogous to the way that a virus will attach itself to a cell and absorb the genetic information for itself, so microscopic cells or forms with this advanced genetic information are constantly coming to Earth in the form of either meteorites or space dust, but cosmic dust filtering down through the air and into plants and animals, and in a virus-like way adding information to biological forms. What is the source of this intelligence? He doesn't know. Maybe we may just have an intelligent universe. So the Earth is simply a degraded or the Earth simply represents a less advanced order of intelligence than exists elsewhere in the universe. So somewhere in the universe there is an intelligence. So he says, therefore, since information requires an antecedent intelligence, which it does, that's why monkeys can't type Shakespeare, then there must be an intelligence greater than intelligence on Earth that exists apart from the Earth, and we can call it God. Okay, we would deny this process, which gets affected. But the point is, he doesn't go beyond that. Therefore, rather than having an intelligent God, he has, as the title of his book says, an intelligent universe. And as he's saying, this intelligence simply may exist in and of itself, and Earth is just a recipient of this high intelligence, which is wild, isn't it? Yes.
If he believes that intelligent information is better than being added, then wouldn't he have to explain why the missing of continuing action of evolution around
him? Well, he said that's how evolution took place. He said this is how you suddenly got the new forms. Why there's nothing in the fossil record? How the cold blooded reptile can lay an egg and hatch a warm blooded bird? That this new information was added.
But how would
to the DNA? Which enabled us.
Why did it stop?
It's not stopped, it's really on.
How does it prove that it's still going on?
That's just, you can't prove it, it's just
phenomenological, it is obviously, so that here we are. Now, he's not a Christian, says he never will be a Christian, politics. But he's a Christian. My point is, he showed that, it's very valuable to look from a creationist point of view. Because he's not a creationist. What it is, it becomes a pantheist. I suspect he'll become one of the gurus of the New Age movement. He'll become the guru scientist of the New Age movement. Because that's the intelligent universe is part of that whole shtick. Yes.
Has he even attempted to try to put the probabilities to his theory?
What I would say to Mr. Hoyle is that he has not solved his problem, he simply expanded it.
Put it off until we know more about it.
No. Yeah, that. But he's also said, for instance, if you say, well, if you have intelligence on Earth, if you have information on Earth, it must be explained in extraterrestrial intelligence. And he assigned that to the universe. And I would simply say, if you find information in a universe, you must explain it by an intelligent that is extra-universal, if you have to have an intelligence, if you have to have intelligence beyond the Earth to explain the information on Earth, then you would have to have, it seems to me, an intelligence beyond the universe to explain the information in the universe. He doesn't solve the problem by just getting a higher level of information somewhere else in the universe which is raining down on the Earth. That's what I mean is, he's not solving this problem, he's simply expanding it. It's like it's another form of the argument. Well, I kind of may have misled you, because we're going to come to this next, but you see, when I said that the problem of biotic evolution precedes the problem of chemical or prebiotic evolution is antecedent to the problem of biological or biotic evolution. I'm not suggesting that you start with the problem of chemical evolution, because chemical evolution starts with water and methane. And the question is, where did the water and the methane and the hydrogen come from? That is the problem of the origin of matter. Well, when you get to that area, you see, you get back to the problem of, well, how far back do you go? Now, and you have the problem when you talk about the eternal matter or problem of internal intelligence. I think he's got the same problem with his intelligence that all evolutionists have with matter itself. Y'all see that? Back to the ultimate, to first cause, the ultimate. It's like the old story of the big boy. The big boy. There's a god called Atlas, and he holds the world in children. So he came back and said, well, mother, what? I'll close Atlas up. Honey, she said, I can't believe Atlas is standing on the back of this huge elephant. Now the elephant holds Atlas up, and Atlas holds the world up. Came back and said, well, mother, what holds the elephant up? She said, honey, the elephant is standing on the back of this unbelievably large turtle. The turtle holds the elephant up, and the elephant holds that for some matters of the world. This time he wasn't gone so long. Back then, just a couple minutes of mother, what holds the turtle up? One of the other answers, she said, honey, it's just turtle all the way down. Now, long time, finally came back and asked the ultimate question, which was what? Turtles all the way down the block. The question is, can you have turtles all the way down? You have to ask the question all the way down to what? Maybe go from biotic evolution to prebiotic, to the question of the origin of matter. Eventually, you run down to all the way back to what? See my point? You're right, and so does Hart, I have the same problem. She does not recognize that. Is what, and that is an ultimate, is the problem of an ultimate source of matter, like an ultimate foundation for hurdles, or an ultimate source of information. By the way, I thought it was very valuable for God. I wouldn't accept all particulars of his argument, but I think, do we not believe in an ultimate source of information? And that is a respectful piece on his hand. He was talking about the health of the universe. Any questions on that? Now, the main point of all this in, what I'm trying to teach you is that the why there is, we are in the process, why many are in the process of rejecting the universe, why it has failed. 1925 to about 1970, 1980s, it has failed. You will still find the textbook before you're 50 years old, but it has failed. Here you find examples of those who are not Christians, but they're recognizing that. And I think that admission by Meadowwater, his name was, at Woodstock, he said, we all recognize these problems. And boy, they should get that word down to the kids. The reason I'm giving you this story is because when you deal with the local church, this is where we use it in any church. Well, I'm reminded of the first law of Macbeth, which none of you got except one student, I think. What was the law of Macbeth's first law? The reason you didn't get it was what the syllabus was in your notes. I put it on the board, though. And it should have been in your notes. What was the first one? You cannot maintain a theory simply because it seems to be the best or the only one. It has to be reasonable. Well, what Hoyle is saying is that Darwinism has been accepted because it seemed to be the only theory, not because it was a good one. Now, as I said before, if guys like this have any place to go but Genesis, neo-Darwinism would have been on that scientific basis long ago. And that was my best point. He said, you guys wouldn't hold on to this theory, this concept, if you had where to go. The fact is, what's happening now is that many are saying, like, and this is really what Hoyle is doing. He's saying, and he's one of a large number, we don't know where we're going, but we're going to let go of this theory. We're not sure, it simply won't hold up. Where it's going to take us, we don't know. Once we let go of it, where we end up, who can say? But we're no longer going to hold on to this. Got to be a better answer than this. In the meantime, we'll sell it to the kids, but we'll work on something else. It's exactly what's going on. I think they agree to stuff. We'll work on something else. And we'll feed this to the kids and tell them that we get their creations for sure. Sure is. Well, I hope I made my point to y'all, and you see the nature of it. Well, Goldsmith, we're back in our syllabus, and my syllabus is perhaps somewhat abbreviated at this point. Goldsmith, I pointed out, I listed, we're under page 21, Goldsmith's objection to neo-Darwinism. See, he pointed this out. This isn't all that new. What was happening is that back in 1940, Goldsmith pointed it out, and others, and it was, the neo-Darwinists could not answer him, but laughed at him. He died in sort of disrepute. And then they said, no, we'll figure it out. Well, 30 to 40 years later, behold, all of a sudden, Goldsmith is not so stupid after all. Now, he pointed out the improbability of gradualism and the absence of transitional form in the fossil record. What was the reaction of Neo-Darwin? The reaction to Goldsmith, Neo-Darwinists, I'm reading now, did not even try to meet his challenge, but they declared his explanation untenable and adhered to their assertion that macroevolution can properly be extrapolated from microevolution. On this basis, that the Murray Eden and the others said, no, it cannot be extrapolated. Now, we've talked about the synthetic theory in its three categories, abiogenesis, microevolution, and macroevolution. And I've already made the point that neo-Darwinism has been appealing to the future for proof of the concept. By the way, this is a logical fallacy. To appeal to the future. And appeal to the future. Evolutionists are grossly guilty of this fallacy. And I'm tired.
Are you tired?
I'm going to give you one more statement and I'll let you go. If you go quietly, we're going to come back and do that together to start with. We are bridged as we go on. But listen to this. How would you like to be on trial for your life? Andy, you wouldn't like that going in, but it's a capital crime, and you can see the electric chair. And the prosecuting attorney says, in his summary statement, says this to the jury. Ladies and gentlemen, the jury, I have taken the position Mr. Combs is guilty of murder. He looks like a murderer. We're on solid ground so far, right? Now, I have brought before you a very limited amount of very circumstantial evidence, which is open to many interpretations. And I freely acknowledge that my evidence is very limited, very circumstantial, open to many interpretations. But I know that this evidence in no way establishes the guilt of Mr. Combs. However, I feel very strongly in my heart that he is guilty. I have utter confidence in his guilt. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what I want you to do, I call upon you to find Mr. Combs guilty and allow the state in the proper course of things to execute him. And lest you have any reservations, I assure you that in the next 10 or 15 years, we will find the evidence which proves his guilt. Got one vote already. But you go ahead and execute the old boy with the assurance that after he's dead and gone, we will find the evidence that he was guilty. Now, of course, that's ludicrous, is it not? Oh, listen to me. It's exactly what has gone on in the debate between creation and evolution. The evolutionists since 1925 have been saying to our kids in their textbooks, We declare, we feel in our hearts that creationism is unacceptable. Our evidence is inconclusive and finite. You can go a number of ways. But you go ahead and execute your faith in God. And we assure you that we'll find those laws. And I read to you this morning. Future theory of evolution. We'll find the evidence. You go ahead and execute your faith in God. That is, kill it, let it die. And we'll find the evidence for you. We promise. Are you almost there? Oh no. And many of you thought we had it bailing out, but nevertheless, you see the fallacy of the appeal to the future. And this is exactly what you're going to do. Neo-Darwinism has appealed systematically to the future. The future is not evidence. The future is the future. That's all it is. And we'll start on that point when we come back. Have a good weekend.